The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Care and protection for the whole family's health at All Care, taking care of communities across Ireland.
Yes, good morning to you. A happy Easter Sunday. It's Damien O'Reilly with you between now and 1 o'clock. I do hope you can stay with us. Let's get straight to the Sunday newspapers. I'm going to begin this morning with the front page of the Sunday Independent because they have an opinion poll. Opinion polls are great on Sundays, but this one is in relation, obviously, to the government response to COVID and how we're dealing with it. And the heading is simply COVID, public opinion turns on government. There's been a dramatic upswing in the level of frustration among us. It's a Kantar poll. And just to give you an example of how things have changed, this time last year, approval of the government's response to the pandemic was 78%. So 8 in 10 of us last year were pretty happy and approved of how the government were dealing with it. That has dropped now to 43%. And there's more details from that poll in the inside pages in the Sunday Independent. So it's giving us a sense that, you know, as the weather gets better, we're into Easter, we're a year down the road, we're getting a little bit fed up and we're getting a little bit anxious and we're getting very frustrated and we're getting annoyed. And when you read the front of the Irish Mail, and the Mail have really had a barnstorming week in terms of revealing stories about queue jumping. There's another one this morning: charity workers falsify details for jabs. And the subheading there is cooks and staff working at this home get vaccines. An exclusive there from Michael O'Farrell. Staff at a Limerick charity were told to misrepresent themselves as frontline healthcare workers to be vaccinated against COVID-19. Now, the CEO of that company strongly defends the decision to get staff to do that. About 70 staff, including people that are not actually working on the front line or not working with the children in this facility, they were also getting the jab. And there is some detail of that on the inside pages, and indeed interviews with some of the staff who were very upset, who said that they didn't realise that they were jumping the queue. They thought they were doing everything all right, and now it's been pointed out to them that they were wrong and they're not happy with it, and they're awaiting their second jab. So that story is in the Irish Mail. Then we move on to the Business Post, and this is a story which we've been hearing more and more about in the last couple of days. Donnelly to insist on hotel quarantine list changes despite Fine Gael opposition. The Minister for Health fears that new variants of COVID-19 could threaten the vaccination rollout. So this is all about Stephen Donnelly and the Department of Health looking to include countries like France and Italy and Germany and the US on this mandatory quarantine list, that if you come in from those countries, you must go straight to a hotel. That, we are being told, is being resisted by the Minister for Foreign Affairs, Simon Coveney, and indeed Leo Varadkar. There's some talk that Irish embassies in these countries are being contacted by Irish people who are looking to come home, students who are on Erasmus and exchange courses and so on, who are due to come home in the next few weeks, are saying, well, we can't afford the €2,000. And that's on the front of the Business Post by the political editor Michael Brennan, whom we'll hear from presently. On the Sunday Times, more on that, a kind of another variant of it. If you forgive the pun there, but the more EU states likely to go on quarantine lists. This is a story by Stephen O'Brien. And again, there's a concern about a new variant in France, and government sources, presumably on the Department of Health side, saying that France is, to quote, riddled with it. And they're talking about a new Breton variant as well as the South African variant, which we are told may be resistant to the AstraZeneca vaccine. So that's the concern there on that, and that's on the Sunday Business Post. And then a subheading there: public faith in lockdown falters, and that's in reference to an Amoric poll on the same thing. Now, the Irish Sunday Mirror the Irish Sun on Sunday and the Sunday World. They all go with the story of the two holidaymakers, these two Dublin mothers who returned home, allegedly refused to go into mandatory quarantine, and they appeared in court yesterday. So there's all sorts of quite colourful and, if you want to call it, inventive headlines there to describe their case, which, as I said, was in the courts yesterday. You can read all about that in those papers. And the Daily Star on Sunday goes completely different. It's Uri Geller, Let's Fix the Royals. Spoonbender and Star Readers floated that boat in the Suez. Now for your next mission. So, of course, there's this talk that they turned the ship. So if they can turn that big ship in the Suez Canal, surely they can turn things in the right direction for the royal family. Okay, to my panel here this morning, I'm joined by Gabrielle Colleran, who's consultant paediatric radiologist at the National Maternity Hospital in Holles Street. Nora Casey is broadcaster and publisher. And joining us from afar is Jack Horgan-Jones, who's journalist at the Irish Times. A happy Easter to you all.
Thank
Lovely
you.
To see yourself, Nora and Gabrielle, and Jack, wherever you are. Good morning to you as well. Gabrielle, can I go back to the Sunday Business Post? Let's just go with this one to begin with. And this is, it seems to be, maybe row is too strong of a word, or disagreement in government about how we proceed from here on in relation to visitors coming into this country. We have this long list of countries some of us have never heard of, where at the moment, if you arrive in, you go straight into a hotel. But some of the other countries we're very familiar with, such as France, Italy, Germany, the UK, there's this kind of tug of war in government about whether they should go on the list. And it's on the front of the Business Post this morning, as well as the Sunday Times.
So I think, Damien, you know, essentially what we're seeing here in Donnelly v. Coveney is health versus diplomacy and competing priorities. And, you know, we all love the French, we all love the Germans. You know, we'd love to be able to have people just coming here like normal. But you hit the nail on the head a few minutes ago when you mentioned that France is riddled with the South African variant, which is resistant to the AstraZeneca vaccine. And so, you know, we have to come back to, why is Stephen Donnelly pushing so hard for this? We've been told over and over that vaccination is our key out of this. It's our way forward to normal life. If we import variants that are resistant to the vaccines that we have, we risk going right back to square one and another round of this lockdown surge. And remember again, you know, if healthcare workers are no longer covered by the vaccine, that impacts not only COVID care, it also impacts all the other things we want to do in our hospitals. And so why are we doing this? What does the policy mean? Well, NEFET had three clear criteria. It was around absolute numbers of infections. It was what that was versus our own rate. And it was presence of the variants. Austria, France, Germany, Italy met all three criteria. When we have objective scientific criteria, if we're only applying those to faraway, poorer countries where there are lots of black people, and we aren't applying them to powerful neighbours that are predominantly white Europeans, we don't just look racist, we are racist, and we are making a mockery of our own policy. So Stephen Donnelly is exactly right in what he's doing. I think this is another example of where the coalition need to be exactly that, a coalition, and they need to have their fights. And, you know, as someone who sits on the IHCA Council, we have very, you know, consultants are very dynamic. We have very strongly different views often when we're in the room together. But when we make a decision, then we go out and we defend that decision. And the government essentially have to do the same. And the public will, you know, show no favour to anyone who's pushing to keep France and Germany off the list now just because embassies are getting calls. If that's the reason that we're back in lockdown and more businesses go to the wall. So Stephen Donnelly and Micheál Martin and Leo Varadkar and Simon Coveney need to do exactly what they're telling the rest of us to do. And they need to hold firm. It's, you know, to quote Star Wars, do or do not try.
What do you say, though, that this, you know, to restrict movement of EU citizens would be in breach of the Master Treaty?
So I've seen that discussed, and I've heard people saying, you know, the Attorney General raised this question. But, you know, it's also quite clear that where there's a threat to public health, that member states have the right to take action. So again, it comes back to that communication, that obviously there's that diplomacy part with our neighbour states. But when we're seeing these huge rates and we're seeing jumps in variants in member states, We have to act to protect our society and our economy. Yeah. And we cannot go back to lockdown surge. It's killing our businesses.
Nora, what do you say, though, about all the students in France and Italy that are on Erasmus exchanges and all of that, or Irish citizens that are coming home and say, I can't afford €2,000, or I don't have the time to stay for 2 weeks when I arrive back?
Yeah, there's 700 Erasmus students due back from France, but they have 50,000 cases in France. And, you know, as Gabriella said, the South African strain seems to be resistant to AstraZeneca. And then, of course, everyone's concerned about the other Breton variant that has been talked about at the moment. This is why politics just gets in the way of finding a solution to COVID-19. And we can see that across the board in the papers this morning with the mood of the nation, not just about these constant references to people being vaccinated when they shouldn't have been, but, you know, the wholesale collapse over in the Aviva and City West with people getting double and treble bookings by text and no phone number to call. Then we have this unseemly spat over, let's say, diplomacy. But, you know, that cannot take precedence over the safety of people in this country. There should be no question and no discussion about it. My son has not seen anybody else since last August. He has severe asthma. So although I have sympathies with the students having to stay 2 weeks in quarantine, I don't think it's the worst thing in the world. The second reason that they're stating, not just around the legal issues, but Austria, of course, is currently on the list. So that's an EU country. But they say there's not enough hotel places. I mean, for goodness sake, there are hotels all over this country that would be delighted to get 2,000 for 2 weeks. You can't possibly say that it's all about just a contract with one hotel group. It has to be within our interests and within our abilities to push that out to other hotels around the city so that people can go into isolation when they come here.
Yeah, the hotel group Tifco have requested to increase the number of available beds to 3,000. That's according to the Business Post. That story by Michael Brennan, who's on the line. Michael, good morning.
Good morning, Damien.
Will you bring us up to speed at what is at the centre of this disagreement? To an extent, I suppose, you know, Leo Varadkar and Simon Coveney on one side and Simon Donnelly and his supporters maybe on the other. It's almost a microcosm of the views in the country at the moment, in a way, isn't it? And the split among the public in terms of how we proceed from here on.
Yeah, there's certainly some truth to that, Damien. Interestingly, when we polled on this in the Business Post about 2 months ago with Red Sea, 95% of people polled wanted mandatory hotel quarantine for every country. So in a funny way, this is one issue where, from the public point of view anyway, there does seem to be more uniformity than on other issues such as reopening or pubs and restaurants and so on. I suppose what you have as well is it shows there's a big official reluctance at government level to move to the extreme mandatory hotel quarantine for everyone that Australia and New Zealand did. We went with a starter system. Now it's going to effectively be proposed to go to a medium level. And you can see there's big resistance from foreign affairs and business, which is where Simon Coveney and Leo Varadkar are the ministers. So that's all going to be played out, and it is going to be quite a barony in government.
Yeah. Now, as Gabrielle said there, it's a no-brainer if you have 50,000 cases in France and major problems there, and Italy going into red lockdown this weekend, for example, and Germany a little bit all over the place as well, then why would you not, obviously, quarantine anybody, whether they're Irish or not, coming in from those countries? But then we have this, as you refer to it, the intervention of the Department of Foreign Affairs and the Attorney General. Why is this not as straightforward as we think it should be?
I suppose if you look at it from the Department of Foreign Affairs perspective, they have diplomatic relations with every other country. If we decide to add big, strong countries like France and Germany to the list, we have to explain to them why we're doing it. And, you know, it's not a diplomatically easy thing to do, given that freedom of movement is such a central principle of our EU membership. There's also a practical consideration. You know, your guests have mentioned the extra increase in embassy inquiries, you know, for foreign affairs staff around Europe, and that will be an extra workload for foreign affairs. Now, they don't shirk from that, but it is going to make things much busier for them. So then there's the business concern. You've seen IBEC, the employers group, out opposing a big extension of mandatory hotel quarantine, and that's the belief that Ireland is an open economy. Even in a pandemic, we need to allow people in and out to us as an island. But we are in a pandemic, and I suppose a lot of our principles and ways of operating have just changed because we've had to.
Well, if we're an open economy and Ibec are against the lockdown of the airports and all that, it could soon become a closed economy.
Yeah, that is the political danger for the government here. We're all fingers crossed hoping that the case numbers don't increase over the Easter and in the weeks after. But if they do, and if this row over extending mandatory hotel quarantine is still going on, you have to remember the main opposition parties, Sinn Féin, Social Democrats, Labour, Solidarity, Build for Profit, they're all for mandatory hotel quarantine for everyone. And their first attack on the government will be, you did nothing on this, you didn't follow public health advice, which is very much strongly for extending the list of countries. And that's a difficult one for the government, you know, so that's the political risk for them if this goes wrong.
All right. This issue, and I think it's actually in the Sunday Times where the Maastricht Treaty, the Maastricht Treaty card is being shown, and the intervention of the Attorney General in relation to this. But then I have a text in here. Austria is on the current quarantine list and it's an EU member. So what's the legal issues with France, Germany that Simon Coveney talks about? And Nora mentioned that a little bit earlier as well. So that's one question to you, Michael. But also, what is the situation in other countries? If Irish people, for example, want to travel to Italy, France or wherever, will they be forced into mandatory quarantine in other EU member states?
At the moment, Damien, they won't. The only other EU, the only other significant country in Europe that has mandatory quarantine is Britain. They're implementing their own system. They're outside the EU. You have Norway as well. Again, that's part of the wider European Economic Area. They have a system. But other European countries are land-based. You know, you can travel right across Europe from country to country. So mandatory hotel quarantine just isn't something that's effective for them. Now, we have our own issue with the border here with Northern Ireland. That is a big problem. But Britain is implementing a mandatory hotel quarantine system, and that does tighten it up a bit from our point of view. Just on the legality point, you know, the legislation was passed a couple of weeks ago. It allows Stephen Donnelly, as Minister for Health himself, to designate extra countries if there's a high risk of importation, of infection or contamination, or if there's variants of concern. Now, the only thing is, he does need to get the backing of Paul Gallagher, the Attorney General, to say that his decision is legal, and also he needs to show it's proportionate, that he's not overreacting. Mm-hmm. But you've been listing off the variant threat, the number of cases in big European countries. There's certainly a strong case that it is proportionate.
Okay, you mentioned there about mandatory quarantine in Britain. Does that include Northern Ireland? In other words, could people fly to Belfast and drive down to the south?
What's happening there at the moment is if somebody comes from a country, say like South Africa, and flies into Heathrow and they want to fly on to Belfast, they have to quarantine in a hotel in England for 10 days there, it is effectively. Now, effectively they will have done their quarantine in England before they fly on to Belfast. There's still an issue, though, of people perhaps coming in some roundabout route and getting, you know, into Northern Ireland and going across the border. They're supposed to declare themselves here and go into mandatory hotel quarantine, but obviously that's very unlikely. So our system is not perfect, but then obviously, you know, so many of the things we're doing in this pandemic are not perfect, but they're the kind of best attempt.
Yeah, somebody has texted in here to say, let the Erasmus students stay for free in quarantine when they arrive home. Just one final question to you, Michael. In peacetime, if you had a kind of a breakdown of communication between government ministers in a coalition, you know, the alarm bells would start ringing about a visit by the Taoiseach up the park to Michael D. Is there any threat of the breakup of this coalition to the point that we could be looking at an election? I know it sounds crazy in a pandemic, but even this time last year, there was talk of when we couldn't form a government.
I think it's safe to say, Damien, there's zero threat of that at the moment, because the pandemic, even though it causes rows between the party, it's still a glue, because, you know, it's impossible to hold an election at the moment, and there isn't any genuine desire. I would say Micheál Martin, the Taoiseach, has a kingmaker role. He's kept his silence on this so far. He's probably waiting for the legal advice from Paul Gallagher, who he appointed as Attorney General. And then so is the Green Party. No position from them yet. So if they, both of those sides decide to back where Stephen Donnelly is coming from, you know, that will increase the pressure on Fine Gael. And they may indeed have a change of heart as these days go on, you know, before the next cabinet meeting.
All right, we let you off to enjoy your Easter egg there. Michael Brennan, political editor of the Business Post, thank you very much indeed for joining us with that update. Jack Horgan-Jones, good morning to you. Just want to move on maybe back to the Sunday Independent and... obviously, it all relates to now public opinion. We've been talking about disagreement in government there, and I think, as I said, it replicates a general disagreement in public discourse about how we move on from here. And that's reflected somewhat in this public opinion poll in the Sunday Independent. Take us through it there.
Yeah, so I think what the opinion poll in the Sunday Independent shows us in data and in hard numbers is a feeling that a lot of people will have been picking up on the ground already, and that feeling is that confidence is ebbing from the government, and that confidence is ebbing probably from the National Public Health Emergency Team as well, and that people are fed up at this stage, and that they no longer believe that the government, that a majority no longer believes that the government is doing a good job. 43% only now approving of the handling of the crisis by the coalition. And I think what's remarkable is just how quickly that has grown. So that's a 19-point increase from November, December, and a 35-point increase from this time last year. So you can really see that kind of bedraggled mood of the nation is now very clearly coming through in all the opinion polls that we're seeing, and this one in particular, which takes a wider look outside of just party support and looks at, you know, how good a job are we doing on things like the rollout. Again, 54% say we should be doing a better job there. The question, I think, for the government is that I don't think anyone in government buildings or in Leicester House generally is labouring under the misapprehension that this is a particularly popular or easy moment for the coalition. The question is whether it can sustain itself through these crises, through these very difficult challenges like mandatory hotel quarantine, like getting some of the bad news away from the vaccine rollout and towards this kind of sunny uplands that a lot of people think is coming through June, July and into August, when we actually have a level of vaccination whereby we can start to reopen the economy and people can start seeing each other again. And I think there's a growing impatience in a lot of the government parties around that. We can see that starting to kind of break the surface. For example, at the Fianna Fáil Parliamentary Party last week, John Lahart, the Dublin TD, made the point that if there's no polling bounce for Fianna Fáil, there needs to be, and this was a wonderful piece of rhetoric, a conversation. And people are seeing that very much as a shot across the bows of the leadership. And I think that the same kind of unrest, the same kind of dissatisfaction and impatience is across the coalition parties. So can they make it through, or will they stumble and fall through the very thorny and difficult terrain that is pandemic politics? I think that remains to be seen. But I do think that if they do make it through, that then they can probably expect a better kind of spring or the summer and into autumn. But yeah, the question is, can they make it that far?
Okay, Nora, Paul Moran of Cantor kind of uses the football analogy that the manager has lost the dressing room here. Is that the case? Has the government lost the public, regardless of what opinion the public might have? And for people that want a stronger lockdown and people want to open it all up, they're at one and they're being fed up.
Yeah, and there's actually opinion pieces right across some of the newspapers today about that mood changing, and you can feel it on the ground. I certainly can feel it. And I think there's just a perfect storm. There's the whole vaccine debacle, people understanding now that a lot of people in the HSC got that vaccine that weren't in frontline patient-facing jobs. Then you see the Daily Mail today on Sunday talking about the Limerick charity and whether people are fibbing in order to get the vaccine. And then, of course, for a smart little tech country on the periphery of Europe, we proved ourselves to be totally incompetent when it came to apps and IT in terms of, you know, managing the data analytics, manage contact tracing, managing, you know, all those people who got texts about the Aviva and City West who had already been vaccinated didn't even have a phone number for them to call to say, you know, you've just contacted me inadvertently. So hundreds and hundreds of slots there left vacant. So people are annoyed and irritated by this. But let me tell you one thing. I don't know where IBEC is coming from with an open... Closed economies like New Zealand and Australia and Taiwan are the ones that are doing really, really well in terms of opening up business and opening up the economy. our country really badly needs, you know, the government needs to have good PR advice, because when they say we're all in it together, when I see three men in suits with ties on at a podium talking at us and scolding us, it does not feel they have any empathy with people in this country. And people feel the unfairness of that. And they feel irritated by some things that make absolutely no sense. Click and collect makes no sense to me. The idea that you can meet with two families, but not in your own private garden. What does that tell you? We don't trust you. So if you keep making rules and rules and rules, people will find ways to break the rules. You need at one point to say, one out of 10 maybe are misbehaving. Stop talking to them because they're not listening to you. You need to talk to the 9 out of 10 who, by and large, are behaving really well, trying to comply with all of the guidelines. Give them some trust. We all know now how to meet with somebody else and not to cause any difficulties in terms of COVID or transmission, I would say. So you're taking all of the trust away from people, all the autonomy away from people. And you also have, what are they doing in suits behind a podium? It's like something out of yesteryear. I don't get it at all. Firstly, no women. 40% of cabinet subcommittees, no women. Look at areas in the world. I used to say if women ruled the world, we'd be a better place. Just turns out that in areas of the world where women rule, we are in a better place. Less COVID, less COVID deaths. Get the suits off. Get the ties off. Roll up your sleeves. Look like you look a little bit more like us. We're all in our athleisure, sitting in our sitting rooms, watching you behind the podium talking at us instead of talking with us.
Yeah, we saw Leo Varadkar when he became Taoiseach arriving into the Dáil in his running gear. So,
but Jacinda Ardern is with her baby late at night doing live video to her fellow countrymen and women, letting them know, I'm here with you. I'm going through exactly what you're going through. I don't think anybody feels that the men who are standing at the podium are going through anything like what the rest of us are
going through. Gabrielle, you're nodding in agreement there.
Oh, I'm just feeling so overjoyed to hear somebody articulate what I feel so deeply within my being. I mean, when representation is representative and inclusive, we get better decisions. There's been a ton of research done on this. You know, societies that are being led by women, we prioritise, as women, longer term social well-being over shorter economic concerns. And almost the paradox of that is that economies that are being led by women are predicted to shrink by 5.5% versus 7% for economies led by men. So when you prioritise that long-term social well-being and when you're more inclusive in your decision-making patterns, it actually benefits the economy, which, and you know, oftentimes we're being told we're making this decision for the economy, but actually no, when we take that broader social view. And I'm furious when I look and I see all these men lined up. Women are 51% of the population and yet we're so underrepresented at the decision-making table, which was just really typified by children's shoes not being made essential until Dr. Niamh Lynch stood up and said, no, this has to be addressed. And it's not just women, it's all minoritized groups, it's travellers, it's black people, it's everyone.
It's diversity.
If we look at the last crash back in 2008, global inequality widened. We saw the rise of populism. We need that not to happen again now, because we need to make better decisions. We need to elect more women and we need to mandate. It's wonderful today, Damien, that you have myself and Nora here with Jack. So we have a panel that at least has broadly got gender representation.
I know, but we would have had a woman on that podium if the Green Party members had voted for Catherine over Eamon. And that was very recent. So, you know, the three of them...
But
the three of them just happened to be the leaders of the three parties.
Can I just say to you, if I was saying to you 40% of cabinet subcommittees have no men on it, we would be having a totally different conversation. It's almost accepted. And it isn't just about gender. Exactly what Gabriella said, it's about diversity. If you have a whole bunch of people sitting around a table who are all the same, come from the same background, you don't get good decision making. And women aren't... We have no magic fairy dust. It's
we have empathy. Isn't politics very, very... It's gone so toxic now, and that, you know, that big question still remains, you know, how woman friendly is politics? How friendly is politics in general? I mean, I know you talk an awful lot about we don't have enough business people around the cabinet table. Who in the right mind running a business would want to run for politics? Now, when you see stories about Leo Varadkar having to increase his personal security and the abuse women politicians in particular get online.
Okay, just let me tell you one thing about that. You don't necessarily have to go into politics to make your voice heard. So in the UK, there's a small business advisory group that has 22 entrepreneurs and business leaders on it. We don't have such a group in this country. We have civil servants and politicians talking about business as though they know something about it. I can tell you, for somebody who never knew what insomnia was until I had my own business, I thought I worked hard in the corporate sector. I live, eat and breathe my business. No sick days, no holidays. My whole lifetime has been spent building a business to pass on to my child. And by the way, I went to a Desh school, eight of us in an OPW house. Right across this country, there are families, multiple lifetimes invested in small businesses that are trying to get on their feet again and come out when we do open in the economy. And chances are they won't, because the pandemic supports are gone at the end of June. So I always say, you could be in Westport, you could be in Cork, and you could be owning a coffee shop there. And it's not that there's no need for a coffee shop in the future, but Starbucks will have it, because we're not helping them. And the reason we're not helping them is there's no high-end expertise and advice.
Yeah, but just coming back to my point there about people going into politics, you know, the way politics has gone now, how toxic it is, how, Gabrielle as well, you know, the online commentary, we're all fed up and we're really annoyed, and a lot of people vent that fury, we'll say, online, but it's become so toxic, particularly, as I said, aimed at women politicians. And we've heard an awful lot of cases on programmes like this about how difficult it is for women politicians in particular.
But Damien, there's so much that we can do about that. I mean, if we look at the gender quotas and we see some of the bigger parties like running women just as token candidates to meet the gender quota, but not investing them, putting the money behind the man, they think. And I'm so sick of seeing mediocre men on all sides of the aisle and all, Aaron, get promoted. And, you know, women have to be exceptional. So I live for the day when mediocre women have it as good as the very many mediocre men that we have. So there's a lot that we can do about. And look at the airwaves. Women are 51% of the population. We're approximately 25% of the representation on the air. So the government could mandate that everybody that's getting funding from the government actually has to have appropriate gender representation. But, you know, all women, like, I'm a very highly educated middle class woman. I don't, you know, have the lived experience of travellers or of black women. They need to be here with their voices representing their communities. And that's how, you know, diverse societies, inclusive societies are more innovative. As we come out of COVID and we move forward, our big challenge is climate change. And I'm just, I have to say this, Damien, while I'm here. Pandemics used to be hundreds of years apart. They're now 14 to 20 years between SARS and this. We could well have a bigger pandemic in 10 years' time that Ireland will have to face. Are we going to be better prepared? Vietnam has had, even though it's a lower income country than we are, has had, you know, Fintan O'Toole commented on this yesterday in the Irish Times. They've had a good pandemic because they learned from SARS. They invested in public health IT, in public health infrastructure, and so they are ready. We need to be ready. We need to address climate change. We need to do all of this. Part of that is being innovative. It's being inclusive. And what we've learned from this pandemic is that when women are excluded from the decision-making table, we lose out on a lot. Everybody, not just women, but men, children, everyone loses out on all that expertise, which there's a huge amount. We all do better when we have representative representation. And as Nora says, I'm not a business person. So if I was making the recommendations of how, you know, as a civil servant, how the government is going to support business, that's not going to be as good as if someone like Nora, who has huge expertise in successful business making, is giving me the advice on how best to do that. So we have to improve the process around it. In terms of politicians, I would agree with you, Damien. It's particularly toxic for women. They are held to a different standard. But we can do a lot about that in terms of, you know, the online platforms, Facebook, Twitter, a lot of them have bases here. We can do a lot about what's allowed and what's tolerated on these platforms. Right. And also, men especially, men like you, Damien, who can be allies to women like me, need to call out their friends and co-workers when they are being inappropriately gendered in how they police women's tone online. And I see this all the time. Yeah. When good men stand back and give their pals a pass, well, you know what? That's not good enough.
Okay, Jack Horgan-Jones, I'll bring you back in here. And just on the issue of queue jumping, and there are two pieces today, the Sunday Biz, or the Business Post is called now, Elaine Byrne, those who jump the queue for vaccines are breaking our trust. So it comes back to trust as well. I see Justine McCarthy in the Sunday Times, queue jumping for jabs is completely out of line. So this also has tested our trust in the system, hasn't it? These stories in relation to the Beacon and the Coombe and others as well.
It certainly has, yeah. And funnily enough, a lot of the defences of the vaccine programme have been kind of bullheaded in a lot of ways. You know, it's basically been, look, you know, there may be small issues around the sides, but aren't we pressing on and aren't we getting the jabs in arms? And, you know, I think something that has fallen to the wayside has been a more kind of holistic view of it, but one that incorporates fairness at its core. And that not only is important, like just on a kind of first principles level, but also it's more generally important for the rollout of vaccination programs. And I think that the pieces by Elaine Byrne and Justine McCarthy both make this point very well. Vaccination programs depend on buy-in. They depend on people believing that the decisions, the right decisions, are being made in the right way. And when you have things like the Coombe, and you have things like the Beacon Hospital, where there's a kind of rank sense of entitlement associated with them. And when you have a system which clearly, according to the Mail on Sunday splash today, not only is open to misuse, is actually being misused in practice, I think that risks detracting from the overall success of the vaccination rollout, which is, as Gabrielle said at the top, it's at the very core of the next phase in Irish life and Irish pandemic policy. You know, we have put all the chips on vaccines. We have to get this right. So it's a little frustrating when we saw during the week widespread journalism work which showed that, you know, one could go on and book effectively on false pretenses a slot on the portal. And the HSE effectively just dismissed that and said, well, sure, look, you know, when you turned up, you'd be validated at the time. And now you have this splash in the Mail on Sunday, which fundamentally undermines that explanation. And it does raise wider questions about fairness. It raises wider questions about the values that we're incorporating into the rollout of the vaccine program, and ultimately calls into question, I think, most dangerously, you know, the success of it, because it depends on buying. It depends on all of us effectively agreeing to support it, both in deed and in spirit.
Yeah, and Nora, in the Business Post, Daniel Barron has a piece there, Outrage, Hope and Talking to Joe. So again, you know, is the public, are politicians, are they looking over their shoulder at what people are saying to Joe, listening to what they're saying to Joe and what people are saying on Twitter? Is that dictating the narrative, and is it a healthy thing that politicians are afraid to go against the populace?
I think the opposite, actually. So if you read that piece, you know, what they're saying is there's this lovely slick veneer that's going on at the moment. We hear all the ads on radio and television about the vaccination programme, and it's all very effective and it's rolling out. And then you see all these reports that we've just been talking about, that Jack's just been talking about. So underneath, people are thinking, nobody's telling the truth. My mother is 90. She's going to murder me for that now, by the way, and everybody listening straight afterwards. She's 91 in August. She got her second vaccine yesterday, but a very anxious time from December all the way through to 4 weeks ago when she got her first vaccine. Lots of people in our circle over 70 still waiting for vaccinations. So we're looking at all of this happening with the 100,000 or so that got a vaccine inadvertently through fibbing, or maybe just subconsciously. And then we have all of these people who are seriously worried about, you know, elderly people, seriously worried about when they're going to get the vaccine. And we're hearing these ads constantly. So maybe Talk to Joe is the only way that people have telling what's really happening.
I know, but a lot of that, a lot of the outrage has been in relation to the decision by the government last week to vaccinate by age downwards rather than by profession.
Yeah.
You talk about your mother, obviously, and all of us that have, you know, parents or elderly relatives, we're all delighted and we're tweeting about it and all of that when they get the call and they're being vaccinated. But then there are the teachers and the guards and the other frontline workers further down the age line that are now saying, hold on. And actually, there's a piece in the front of the, sorry for cutting in you there, but I'll go back to the Sunday Independent. I have it here. And on the front page there is actually a little story.
The armed guardie, is it?
It is. Yeah. It's about the armed guardie had to retreat from virus.
It was the irony of that story, because he was COVID positive, obviously, when they went to arrest him.
And they went to arrest, just to put it in context, they were arresting somebody that was obviously one of the protesters, am I right?
If I
remember how, in breach of the COVID regulations. Yeah. And when they arrived to arrest him, and they had full support behind him, they had to retreat because the person
was COVID positive.
So that kind of is the argument from the front line, from the Gardaí, that look, we're most at risk, and that's why we need to actually get the vaccine quicker.
I think my own view is I have every sympathy with teachers, with Gardaí, with carers in particular, because, you know, even though people of a certain age are vaccinated, the people who are caring for them aren't. And if they collapse, there really is no support. You can't backfill those vacancies. People in their own homes being looked after by a 70-year-old or a 65-year-old currently. Nonetheless, my old chairman, God rest his soul, used to say, when you fail, fail fast. And I think that the vaccination programme failed. I know that everyone's saying it was because of supply issues, but it was overly cumbersome, overly complicated. We didn't have the IT support in order to ensure that it was rolled out effectively and fast. So at this point in time, I support the age-related vaccination programme because it simply will get it out quicker. And it also will get older Gardaí, older carers and older teachers vaccinated at the exact same time. If we sit and argue for the next 4 weeks about the professions, I feel we're going to be into September, October before people get a first vaccine.
I'll bring the medic in here. Gabrielle, what's your opinion on this?
So I think, you know, whichever metric we use, whether we use the prior one or the current one, there will be always people and groups who will benefit from the different change in metric. But if we actually look objective, you know, England essentially used age-based aside from their high-risk cohort. And outside of healthcare professionals, age is actually a much stronger predictor than your professional status. The other thing which we can't underestimate and which Nora touched on there is the IT issue. So Ireland is an outlier in that we do not have an individual health identifier, a unique health identifier. In the UK, every person in their equivalent of category four, you know, their high risk vulnerable, has been on a database since March 2020. It was very easy for them to pull them out. In Ireland, you know, we're, you know, there's duplication, people are getting multiple texts because consultants like myself are having to go through charts, pull out patients, find letters, try and identify the high risks, because we don't have that embedded IT where there's a robust public health, GP and hospital IT system that all communicate and that all have it all under the one number. And Damien, you might say to me, well, Gabrielle, why is that one number important? I mean, obviously that's going to make it a little bit less cumbersome. It'll make it, you know, a little bit administratively easy, but it's actually key to how we respond to the pandemic. And I'll use myself as an example. I'm a healthcare worker. I've had multiple COVID tests. They're all out there on the ether in the system associated with my date of birth. But the system doesn't recognise them as being me because they're not under my unique health identifier. I've now been vaccinated. If I get COVID in 2 months' time, the public health doctors would like to know, am I one of that small group of people who the vaccine didn't take in, as we know happens in a small number, less than 5%? Was there a batch failure? Did that batch just not work? And do they actually need to go back now and do, you know, extra vaccination in the same group of people that got my batch? Or am I now infected with a variant that has come in because we don't have proper mandatory quarantine? All of which would have significant public health ramifications. And if we want to move forward to a system where we're going to do individual targeted measures, jumping onto clusters, doing disease investigation, we need to get that unique health identifier. Okay. We needed it 20 years ago, we need it now. And we need the public health IT and the public health specialists to be able to do that deep contact tracing that we haven't been able to do and which has led to lockdown and surge.
Well, I just want to ask you, Gabrielle, on that. You, as I said, you're on the front line, you're a medic. And people, the vast majority of people listening to us aren't. And we all have opinions on what we should be doing and how we're going to get out of this. For God's sake, all we want is to get vaccinated and get back to relative normality. And again, in the Sunday Independent this morning, people are talking about when they think we will be back to normality. And I think vast majority are probably saying it will be a year or next year when that happens. So how do we get to a situation where this summer we can go visit friends, we can go have a pint with our friends, we can go out for a meal with our loved ones, we can maybe go on holiday, or dare I say it, that we can actually think about booking holidays abroad. Now, you as somebody that's very clued in on a day-to-day basis, looking and analysing the data, give us your opinion on that and your predictions.
So, Damien, from March 2020, myself and my husband stayed away from his parents because we didn't want to bring COVID into the house. And my mother-in-law died in February, having only seen her grandchildren, her only two grandchildren, with one garden visit in August. I really want my kids to see their granddad over the summer. It may well be his last summer. He's had his first shot of his vaccine now. He'll get his second one in 3 weeks' time. Best and quickest pathway to that is as supply rapidly increases, which it is going to in April, May, we get as many jabs into as many arms as quickly as possible. Because as Tony O'Brien said in today's Sunday's Business Post, every jab that goes into every arm confers an element of protection to all of us, because the more jabs, the less COVID, the better we are. Age isn't perfect, but given that we don't have a unique health identifier and it is so hard to actually pull people out by occupation, we would lose a ton of time. As Mike Ryan says, speed trumps perfection. Yeah. The decision to move to age
you know, outside of category four is the right one, and it's going to get as many jabs into as many arms as possible. If we can keep the variants out and up our vaccination, I really hope that I'm going to be sitting in Kerry eating crab claws, you know, in a pub with my father-in-law, with the grandchildren, saying, please, can we have crisps and Coke? And that's my dearest hope for August, and I still believe it can happen. It does need the trust, and what we've referred to today, every single breach where we see people abuse the authority they have when they are distributing the vaccines, which, as Taoiseach said, belong to the Irish people. Every breach, whoever it is, damages public trust. It damages public confidence. It's really so bad for us as a community. And it's wrong. It has to stop. Okay. People have to have confidence.
All right. OK, will you stay with us? My panel this morning here, Gabrielle Colleran, Nora Casey and Jack Horgan-Jones. We'll be back after this.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Now, there were more disturbances on the streets of Northern Ireland last night, and Alison Morris, crime correspondent from the Belfast Telegraph, is on the line. So, Alison, what's been happening up there?
Well, we've had almost a week of violent clashes in Derry, in the Waterside, with loyalists attacking police, and then that had spilled over the weekend down into parts of Belfast. There was a riot at Sandy Row and Shaftesbury Square, which would be close to Belfast city centre, on Friday evening. And then last night we've seen even more violence, which stretched out to Newton Abbey, where police came under attack from petrol bombs and stones and bricks and masonry from, and this is all linked to, I suppose, a growing disquiet among sections of loyalism, which has been exasperated in recent weeks, I think, by some of the political utterances and the fallout from the PPS decision not to prosecute any members of Sinn Féin over the funeral of Bobby Storey.
And that, of course, follows, you know, the Northern Ireland Protocol and the feeling among certain unionists and loyalist groups that they're kind of being hung out to dry by Downing Street.
There is. It's a sort of an imperfect storm, if you like. So we've had the anger over the protocol and, you know, as we know, Northern Ireland voted to remain, but large sections of unionism voted to leave, and the consequences of that have been that, you know, some kind of mitigation had to be put in place for the border. And they feel that they've been betrayed by Boris Johnson, because obviously the solution to that in the protocol was to put the checks in the Irish Sea. They see that as a sort of economic United Ireland and a stepping stone to uniting the island after any future border polls. So that has angered them. I think that, you know, the problem is, if you try and drill down as to what is going on within unionism, there's so many agendas at play. It would require, you know, require dissertation rather, you know, than a handful of words. But basically, this has been something that's been going for some time. I think the loss of the union's majority at Stormont during the last elections destabilised sections of loyalism. The protocol has added to that. Recent events where they feel, you know, they've lost control in terms of the police, the judiciary, all of those things which are now, would have been almost exclusively unionist at one time, and are now much more balanced up in favour of both communities, and all of that, I think, is you know, adding to the lack of confidence among unionist communities. But the problem is too is with the leadership of unionism, which continually tells people to be angry, you know, to be angry at a series of events, and that's going to end up spilling onto the streets eventually. We have sections of loyalism who were itching to take, you know, their opposition to the protocol onto the streets, and had said only the pandemic was stopping that from happening. And, you know, attacks on the chief constable by political unionism this week, saying that there was no faith in him and his position was untenable and he should resign, has almost given justification to those people who were looking to take themselves out onto the streets and cause violence.
Yeah, and a lot of them, young people, you know, they're three teenagers due to appear before Belfast Youth Court on the same day. You mentioned the phrase there, political unionism, which I find interesting, because we do remember, well, most of us old enough to remember going back to the Good Friday Agreement and around that time, that, you know, the Ulster loyalism had a voice in the likes of Billy Hutchinson and David Irvine. Those sort of voices, political voices, they're not there anymore. They're not prominent anymore. It's the UUP and the DUP, who probably a lot of these younger people in the Sandy Row area that feel disaffected have no real connection with.
No, and the fact is, you know, that loyalism did not vote for those parties who were previously aligned to paramilitary groups. They did vote for the DUP, and a significant amount of their vote would come from working class loyalist communities. And, you know, and they take their lead from them. So, you know, I think, and I've been saying the last week, people need to be very careful with their language, because we have people who, young people who are very impressionable. And also, you know, I mean, there's other reasons too. We have high levels of unemployment and educational underachievement, especially among, you know, young loyalist men, and that all creates a situation, I think, where those people are ripe for exploitation, you know, by paramilitary groups, which continued to recruit long after the Good Friday Agreement. You know, loyalist paramilitary groups have continued to recruit young people into the ranks, and that has been done for quite some time. And it's, I find it very depressing watching the age of some of those young people who were involved in those disturbances. I'm pretty sure that they don't, if you ask them, understand the complexities, you know, of sanitary checks at the sea border, or, you know, the customs arrangements between Northern Ireland and Great Britain and the rest of the EU. But they do understand very sort of divisive language, you know, such as betrayal, such as economic United Ireland, and, you know, no to, you know, Ulster says no to the sea border and all those sort of things. Mm. They resonate with them. So, and I mean, another section of youth, I mean, you're just going to lose those young people, because once they get into that cycle and they get a criminal record, their entire lives are going to be marked by it. And, you know, I find it so sad and depressing when you see someone who has their whole life ahead of them, mm-hmm. and he's been sucked into that cycle of violence.
Yeah, well, as always has been the case over the last number of years in the North and Northern Ireland, has been language, and Sinn Féin MLA Gerry Kelly has claimed the latest disturbances were a direct consequence of the actions of political unionism, and obviously the calls earlier this week by the DUP for the chief of the PSNI to step down and so on. So language is very important. Alison, we're going to leave it there. Thank you very much for joining us on the phone this morning. Jack Horgan-Jones, you know, the pandemic aside, this is another very serious issue which obviously needs the attention of Micheál Martin and Leo Varadkar as well.
I think that's true. I mean, what is happening in the North is a manifestation, or at least partially a manifestation of increasing unionist fears over being cut off from Britain, and, you know, as Alison was outlining there, the shifting sands of politics in the North, which gave credence to the idea of a border poll. What we can't get away from is the fact that in Stormont, it seems to be an increasingly dysfunctional political system, an increasingly dysfunctional vista. You have the head of government up there effectively, you know, trying to force out the police chief responsible for policing the very violence that's taking place. And from a Dublin point of view, from an Irish government point of view, they will be trying to chart a path through this morass, really. And you know, Micheál Martin has set up the Shared Island unit to try and answer some of these vexed questions, but I don't think there are any easy answers at the moment, and mm-hmm. it's something that, you know, the government down here really has to play its part in getting to grips with. But it's also something that top-down political leadership can only do so much about. I think that Eoin O'Brien was on the Katie Hannan programme yesterday, and he made the good point that at times like these, really, the voices have to emerge from within the unionist or nationalist communities themselves to put order and shape on what's going on. And the fact that that doesn't seem to be happening at this point is perhaps the most unsettling thing at this juncture, that you know, that leadership from below, the leadership from within the ranks and within the communities seems to be absent.
Okay. I'm going to come back to a couple of the texts that have actually come in. Nora and Gabrielle. Okay, so I'm quoting our listeners now, who are entitled
the
to their opinion.
The women are taking over.
Well, we invite our listeners to text in. They're listening to what you're saying. What utter crap? So wearing suits is now a problem. That's from one texter. Belgium, Nora. Belgium had a woman PM and they had the worst figures, and somebody else pointing to Northern Ireland, where, of course, the First Minister and Deputy First Minister are both women. We have another one in here. Stuck in a raging pandemic, and you go down the women rabbit hole. You're all pathetic. That's from John.
Were they all bad? Come on.
No, they weren't. Because finally, we have a measured and intelligent discussion on the radio this morning, Damien. Pray we have the politicians listening to this. And that comes in from Sharon. So
let me tell you, it's only a while ago we were discussing our Minister for Justice having to resign because she couldn't get maternity leave. And by the way, you don't have to believe me. Two big universities in the UK did a study of 187 leaders in the world, 10% were women, and they proved categorically that in those countries there were less COVID cases and less COVID deaths. So I didn't dream off all of the countries that have women leaders. And it's not, I'm not doing it as a subjective. My point, today you'll read about domestic violence. I'm somebody who went through an abusive marriage for 9 years, so I'm very close to women in that space, and I have a small cohort of them that I look after. 6 out of 10 perpetrators in this country get suspended sentences. We're seeing today, not to make it complicated, but the government signed up to the Istanbul Convention, which means 1 in 10,000 people, we should have a refuge place for 1 in 10,000 people. The government has chosen, I say deliberately, because they've refused to back down, that they will interpret that as 1 in 10,000 women. So they have 330 less places for women who are escaping violence and abuse in their home. And during the pandemic, we've just discovered today that 216 requests were turned down because we didn't have those places. Mm-hmm. This is a terrible comparison, but the Taoiseach got death threats and he moved house recently. We have a 1.8 metre fence around Stephen Donnelly's house because he got threats. I abhor violence against anyone, but no one life is worth more than another. So why are we leaving 213 families in violence and not protecting them?
By the way, can I just say there, because I have to go to a break before the news, but we got a call this morning. You said the Taoiseach there, a lot of people still call Leo the Taoiseach.
Oh, I did call him the Taoiseach.
There are reports this morning that he's had to move house, but his people have been on to us to say that that is not the case, that he is still where he is, although we do know that he's beefed up his personal security in recent times. And it goes back even to what we were talking about earlier on about the online stuff, whether you're male, female.
Yeah, which you can never condone, but I'm just saying that women deserve to be safe and their children.
And we referred yesterday to the Examiner story yesterday about research in Maynooth University about the effects of the pandemic, particularly on women and women that have been working as well. We're going to have to leave it there, but I really enjoyed your company this morning. Gabrielle Colleran, thank you very much indeed for joining us, and Nora Casey and Jack Horgan-Jones as well, and earlier to Michael Brennan. I hope you go off now and have a lovely and enjoyable Easter.
Thank you.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.